Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am joined by Peter Byram, a drama graduate who got into analytic philosophy and Christian apologetics, ironically through the New Atheist movement. He tells his fascinating story in a new book called Coming to Faith Through Dawkins. Peter, let's return to Dawkins' argument from complexity, because that was really a significant marker on your journey, getting disillusioned with the new atheists. And it was something that came up time and time again, wasn't it, for you?
Yeah. Well, you see, I realised quite early on, even before challenging Dawkins, to his face, that this looked like a really bad argument. But yet he wheels this argument out, you know, in all sorts of media situations, and it's the big argument that he makes. It became very clear that this was very weak. And of course, when it came to the 25th of October 2011, Dawkins did not show up to debate William Lane Craig, and William Lane Craig explained why that argument doesn't work and why all the other objections don't work. What's really fascinating, though, is that watching Dawkins since then, since 2011, since his refusal to debate William Lane Craig, it's been fascinating to watch what's been happening with him and getting even more insight in this. I mean, I do get the impression that his refusal to debate William Lane Craig really has backfired on Dawkins. I mean, at the time as well, I should have mentioned that he was being criticized by atheists as well for not engaging. The atheist philosopher who was at Oxford at the time, Dr. Daniel Kame, had written Dawkins a letter saying, not debating William Lane Craig is a big omission on your CV, and it could be interpreted as cowardice. So this was strong stuff. But Dawkins was just pushing back against this. Now, it's really interesting looking at Dawkins now, because there are some ways in which there might be some glimmers of hope in which he might have changed a bit. But there are other ways in which he is still firmly holding to exactly the same argument as if nothing had happened. Now, I think the first thing that's really interesting to consider would be early 2012. So this is after all of the fallout from Dawkins not debating Craig at the Sheldonian Theatre in 2011. There was a moment during a dialogue with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. It was chaired by the agnostic philosopher, Sir Anthony Kenny. And Kenny was sort of wanting to introduce a new point in the conversation. And he brought up Dawkins' central argument, that argument about God needing to be complex. And he illustrated a point there, which, you know, William Lane Craig had already illustrated this. He'd already explained how Dawkins is getting confused between the thoughts that God is capable of having or the effects that God is capable of creating and the actual complexity of God's composition. But this was a really interesting clip. which I'll play it now. This is 2012, and Anthony Kenny makes a really interesting little analogy to try and make this point, raising this question about Dawkins' argument. And it's interesting to watch how Dawkins responds to this.
If we're asking God to be capable of designing the laws of physics, minimally designing the laws of physics, let's say, twiddling the knobs to get the universe's fundamental constants right in order to produce a universe, perhaps dealing with the chemical events of the origin of life, so he's got to be at least as complicated enough to do that, and he's got to forgive your sins and listen to your prayers and all that kind of thing.
But don't we
That's
have
not
to,
a simple creature.
Don't we have to distinguish between two senses of complexity?
Yes.
And of simplicity.
And simplicity.
There is complexity of structure and complexity of function. Now, traditionally, theologians have said that God was simple. That is to say, he had no structure. He was not spread out in space and time. But of course, in saying that he was omnipotent, they said that he had an enormous number of powers, an infinite number of powers. But there is a distinction between complexity of structure and complexity of function. Take my electric razor. It is a much more complicated machine than a cutthroat razor. The cutthroat razor is simple in structure, but it has more complex powers than the electric razor, because the electric razor could only be used to shave a beard, whereas the cutthroat razor could be used to cut a throat.
Indeed, you needn't even have a cutthroat razor. You just find a stone, a flint, and I really don't see what you're saying. I mean, you cannot
just
be serious.
From two senses of simplicity.
Can I have a go?
Yes, please. Yeah. Yes.
Yes, you three are. You can do better.
Not that I know much about razors.
That was great, wasn't it? Don't you just love that mic drop moment from Rowan Williams? That's hilarious. That was, and it broke the tension wonderfully as well. That was a great moment when he did that. I just thought that was a really effective illustration. And it shows, again, Dawkins is assuming that because God is capable of doing really complex things or really powerful things, that therefore God has to be composed of a complex structure. And so, you know, that illustration of, you know, one, you know, the simpler object in structure can actually do more than the complicated, complex structure. So that was a good illustration of how Dawkins is getting confused between these two categories. But you'll notice there, Dawkins' reaction was essentially just to get incredulous and just say, you know, is it sounding almost like John McEnroe, kind of, you cannot be serious. And he didn't really have anything to say about that. He just found the idea of a really powerful God not having a complex structure to just be off the radar. It's as if he couldn't compute it. And unfortunately, Dawkins went on to make some rather negative comments about Anthony Kenny as well. In his forum at richarddawkins.net, he said that Anthony Kenny was just being a meddling chairman who was obscuring the conversation. In another context, in his touring with Lawrence Krauss, he said that Kenny had ruined the dialogue. And so this just seemed like a really sensitive issue for Dawkins. Now, but bear in mind, this is 2012.
Yeah, so because this is what I wanted to ask you about, because that's 2012, yeah. And you know, it's 6 years after the God Delusion, but we're still slightly in the height of the New Atheism, in the wave of the New Atheism. But Dawkins hasn't really shifted much on this position, has he? Because in some ways, I'd love to hear your response to a recent interaction that you had with Richard Swinburne, which we played on an unbelievable episode back in August. Because in some ways, he's just sort of saying exactly the same things, but you know, beyond 10 years after those conversations.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, what Dawkins does is he gives an example of what Kenny calls complexity of function. So he'll say, you know, how can God be capable of designing the fundamental constants, or how can he answer everyone's prayers? And then he will say that God cannot be simple. So he starts with an example of something powerful that God can do, and then basically just says he can't be simple. He doesn't do anything to justify why God would have to have a complex structure, which is improbable, and that's what he needs. And the interesting thing is, if you look at, and that my recommendation, of course, is I'm going to show some clips of Dawkins doing this, but of course, the best thing to do is to go and watch the full event, which we've got on our YouTube channel anyway. So it's definitely worth doing that, watching the whole thing. But it's interesting to watch here. These are all of the moments where Dawkins basically pushes back against Richard Swinburne, because Richard Swinburne, Christian philosopher from Oxford, he's got a whole argument about why God is a simple explanation for the universe, and it includes things like, you know, God is simple because he's not material, he's only one entity that has really great explanatory scope, and all sorts of criteria. And if you watch Dawkins in this little compilation, the question to ask is, whenever Dawkins talks about complexity and simplicity, is Dawkins referring to complexity of function or complexity of structure? So here we go. This is the little compilation that I've got here of all these moments where Dawkins is trying to object during that dialogue with Swinburne.
If you are saying that you need a God to explain why all these electrons and protons are behaving the same way, a God capable of doing that would have to be supremely complicated, and yet you're saying that supremely simple.
Why do you think he's got to be exceedingly complicated?
Because he's got to hold all these electrons in his little hands.
He's not that sort of God at all. He has no extension in space.
Okay, I think that's obviously a trivial point.
What is it about this explanation that you're not happy to entertain, Richard? Is it simplicity?
Isn't it obvious?
Is it simplicity the main point, though? Or is it just something non-physical?
Richard Swinburne is saying that God is simple because he's a single entity.
Yeah.
How can he be a single entity if he's simultaneously controlling the universe, every particle in the universe? He's forgiving our sins. Mm. He's giving us free will. He's deciding whether or not you'll die or not on a certain day. Such a thing is not a single simple entity. It's a highly complicated, mammoth, great, big, fat entity.
Well, take another example of a very simple entity. A particle of matter here. This particle of matter is influencing all sorts of other particles of matter all over the universe. How can it do that with just being one particle of matter? Well, it does, according to the law of gravity.
Well, yes, so what? I mean, that...
Well, you were saying that in order to have a large number of effects, it had to be a big thing. Mm.
In order to do the things that God is supposed to be doing, he cannot be simple. He's an entity of subjective consciousness. He thinks about things. He has free will. He has the power to influence anything in the world that he wants to do. He even does the things that the Christians believe and all the other religions believe. How can you possibly say that such an entity is a single, simple entity? Do you think God can read our thoughts? Can he read the thoughts of everybody in this room?
Yes.
All 8 billion people in the world?
Yes.
And he's simple. He's reading all these thoughts and he's simple. He's not a simple entity. He's reading 8 billion people's thoughts simultaneously.
But that's not the issue at play.
It is the issue. We want a simple explanation, and I'm saying God cannot possibly be a simple explanation. He's a very complex explanation.
Well, I think you get the gist, don't you? That's quite an onslaught. Those are those moments that I've picked out to demonstrate the point. But again, go watch the full event, because it's a good one to watch anyway, and you get to see more of the exchange. But notice what Dawkins was doing there. I think at least 5 times. He repeats that same pattern of, again, Dawkins needs to establish that God is highly improbable, so improbable that he's useless as an explanation. He's the worst possible explanation. Nobody should believe in God because it's a ridiculous explanation for the universe. Too improbable. That's what Dawkins needs to establish for his argument to work. In order to establish that, he needs to argue that God is complex in the sense that God is made of parts that can be assembled, and that is improbable, and so forth. But every single time there, Dawkins repeats this pattern of giving an example of something really impressive or powerful or complex that God can do, and then he just gets incredulous, saying, you know, how could God possibly be simple if he's supposed to do these really big, powerful things? And he just keeps going round and round and round and round. And I think if you'll have noticed as well, at one point he even says, and this gives a bit more insight to sort of confirm it, he even says, how can God possibly be a single simple entity? Which seems to hint even more that God, that Dawkins seems to be conceiving of God as needing to be made of matter. Like if God is a mind, it would have to be attached to a brain with loads of neural networks and all sorts of stuff like that. So the thing that's actually that I came to realize, and this just sheds more light on it, is that Dawkins' complexity argument, it seems to be fundamentally a circular argument, because he's basing the entire definition of God and the entire approach to the argument on assuming that materialism is true, namely that there is nothing beyond the natural material world. And so it's a bit like, I mean, there's a caricature of Christian belief that is sometimes used as an example of circular reasoning. And it is a caricature, though I have actually heard a Christian say this once when Dawkins interviewed him, which was not very inspiring. But I don't know if you've heard, sometimes, the sort of caricature argument to represent circular reasoning will be made, that the Bible is the word of God. I know that because it's written in the Bible. And I can trust that because the Bible's the word of God, because it's written in the Bible, because the Bible's the word of God. And you go round and round in circles and you look at it and think, oh, come on, can't you see what's wrong with that? Well, fundamentally, Dawkins seems to be doing the same kind of thing with his approach to this argument, because it essentially seems to be that something like this, there cannot be a supernatural designer of the universe, because any designer of the universe would have to be more complex and thereby more improbable than the universe, because there cannot be a supernatural designer of the universe. Namely, Dawkins has ruled out unembodied minds or spirits or consciousness. He has ruled out the supernatural options. And what he's calling God is actually a great big gigantic natural physical creature. He's limited himself to the material universe. So the interesting thing about this is that Dawkins could have put forward a really interesting argument against the existence of God. There are probably much more rigorous atheist philosophers out there who are doing things like this right now. If Dawkins had made an argument like this, let's say, he could have done something like, minds cannot exist without bodies. God is a mind without a body. Therefore, God cannot exist. Now, if somebody could defend, you know, an argument like that, that would be a really challenging, interesting argument, you know, that people who believe in God would have to grapple with. But Dawkins doesn't even try. He just assumes that it appears to be. He just seems to be assuming that, you know, if God is an intelligence, it has to come attached to a body and physical properties and all those sort of things. It's fundamentally a circular assumption, I think, that's going on underneath that argument.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support. I think it's so interesting, isn't it, that almost 20 years after he sort of first started to make those arguments, he's still very much sticking to his guns on this and not shifting his perspective at all. But there are definitely moments that we've seen Richard Dawkins perhaps begin to not backtrack, but perhaps show a little bit more nuance or a little bit more openness into some of the things. And again, this was something that appeared on the Unbelievable Show in a big conversation between Richard Dawkins and Francis Collins. And he just seemed a little bit more open, perhaps, to some of those things. And even his attitude in those conversations felt a little bit less combative, didn't it?
That was really interesting. I mean, so that example from the mystery of existence debate, I mean, that was very recent. That was after the book had been printed. So I mean, there's no way of mentioning it in the book. But Dawkins' exchange with Francis Collins in 2022, so just the year before what went on with Swinburne there, I can remember watching that and thinking, this is amazing. And I can only put it down to the good relationship that Dawkins has with Francis Collins. And I think it's a testimony to the fact that this isn't just about the intellectual side. It's not just about arguments. So you do need to be rigorous and make sure that they're good and that they're sound arguments. But it really is important relationally how you're getting on with the other person and how you're listening and how you're interacting. Because there was a moment in Dawkins' interaction with Francis Collins where I wanted to give Dawkins a standing ovation, really. How about this? If I play it, maybe let's just see if we can spot what it is.
Is the issue fundamentally, Richard, that you'll never be satisfied with an immaterial explanation? You'll always be, as a scientist in a sense, and as a materialist, let's face it, you're not going to be satisfied with anything but a material explanation for the material universe we live in.
That's part of it. I suppose perhaps we both come at it from with a bit of emotional, not emotional is the wrong word, a bit of presupposition. As somebody who's deeply steeped in evolution, I am kind of in love with the idea that it's possible to explain complex things in terms of simple things. And that's foreign to normal human nature. It's a difficult thing for humans to grasp. And Darwin's great gift to us, I think, is to show that big complex things can come into existence by an explicable, understandable, beautiful, elegant process of gradual evolutionary change. And that's such a beautiful idea that inventing a big complex thing, which God must be if he exists, throws a ruddy great spanner in the whole works of the beauty of that Darwinian concept of...
You don't like the way the universe looks with
We're
this
both
sort of...
really talking about how we like the universe to look, and I think that's probably...
But I suppose Francis is got this, you know, complex sort of mysterious explanation, as far as you're concerned, for the
universe. I mean, God's got to be complex. I mean, I have come across theologians who say the beauty of God, I think Swinburne, Richard Swinburne, theologian, says God is totally simple. That's the beauty of him. You don't need a complex God. He is simple. And I mean, that's ridiculous, because if he is simple, he couldn't invent the fundamental constants and the laws of physics. And
well, let's Francis, what's your view on
that? Oh, no, I think whatever ability we humans have to try to imagine what God is really like, if God exists, and I believe he does, it's got to be so completely pathetic compared to the reality of that complexity and that awesome capability as a physicist, mathematician, a mind. I think of God as a mind, not as some, you know, gray-haired guy in the sky, which has been an unfortunate image foisted on generations of believers. I don't think God has gender. I think God is a mind that is capable of things that you and I cannot possibly imagine.
If he exists, then that must be what he is. Yep.
Yes, if God exists. Now, you almost sound, Richard, that you would be disappointed ultimately if that was the explanation. You would prefer that there be a sort of Darwinian explanation of the universe itself. That's sort of where your mind goes. You don't like the idea that there's actually is some kind of a mind behind
it.
Yeah,
that's a fair summary of what I just said.
So there you go. I mean, well, I'd be interested to know from you, Ruth, actually, what was there anything in particular that struck you about what, you know, either what that conversation was like or what Dawkins said? I'd just be interested to get your view before I jump in with what
I mean,
think.
To be honest, I had a similar reaction to you when I listened to it for the first time, watched it for the first time. I think I was so struck. I guess I'm so used to, obviously, Richard Dawkins is incredibly smart and I have so much respect for him as a scientist. But, you know, when I remember reading The God Delusion years and years ago when it first came out, when I was studying at university and just being so struck by the tone of it and the kind of aggressive rhetoric and having watched debates, you know, I was always kind of struck by, depending on who the debater was, the Christian was often slightly more gracious towards Dawkins. And what I really loved about that debate was just how cordial they both were towards each other. And I think that's probably not... it's not coincidental in that actually Francis Collins did a fair amount to kind of help Christopher Hitchens in his final years of life. And I think, you know, Dawkins sort of gave him a huge amount of respect, rightly so, because of that. So I think there's all of that at play. But yeah, that was the thing. The tone of Richard Dawkins there was what struck me the most. And it perhaps I've just not seen as much as of Dawkins as I should have done. But in my very limited understanding of Richard Dawkins, his tone there quite surprised me, I think.
Yeah, I there was the same thing. I just got the impression he was loving it. And he still had lots of moments of disagreeing very strongly with Francis Collins. But the two of them, there was a great respect between them. And I'm sure some of the background with Francis Collins, you know, trying to give medical, you know, sort of pioneering medical aid to Hitchens as well was important. And I think it's because of that, something about that relaxed atmosphere. And then, of course, there's Justin being a magnificent host as well. But what I heard Dawkins say, and my ears just pricked up, and I thought, no, he didn't just say that, did he? Was it's that moment where he actually said, well, maybe there's a emotional, maybe that's the wrong word, presupposition. And basically just admitting that he has a sort of a presupposition toward that kind of materialistic, Darwinistic model of explaining things. And that would just, that was jaw-dropping, because I'm used to hearing Christians bang on about the word presuppositions. You know, Christian apologists are always talking about challenge people's presuppositions. There's a whole school of apologetics called presuppositional apologetic. But now Dawkins is just very, just this moment of just, you know, reflection and just very open honesty going in, a sort of, well, maybe I've got some presuppositions in this area. Maybe I'm inclined towards it and I don't like the idea of this kind of God, you know. And then, of course, you know, Francis Collins, you know, he starts by talking about, you know, God is complex, but clearly more in the sense of God is just kind of awesome and, you know, would have all kinds of amazing in-depth sort of thoughts and capabilities and that kind of thing. But then even Collins got round to saying, you know, well, God wouldn't be like a person who has, you know, gender and stuff. God would be a mind. And even then, it was interesting. Dawkins seemed to be open at that moment, even to the idea that God might be a mind. Now, I don't know whether Dawkins in that moment was still picturing a mind as being necessarily tied down to neural networks or something and complex in that way, or whether Dawkins is still conflating the thoughts of a mind with the mind itself, like William Lane Craig has criticized. But that just made me think maybe there's a little glimmer of hope here. Now, clearly the following year, this year, when he was actually interacting with Swinburne, it didn't go quite so well. And unfortunately, he reverted back to the old sort of equivocating and all of those problems. But it just seems to me, I would be fascinated to know, and I'd love to ask Richard Dawkins that, you know, if, and for him, it's probably a really big if, it would probably be crazy to consider this, but, you know, if it could be shown to him that God was ultimately simple in the sense that God is immaterial and doesn't have to evolve into parts, I mean, how elegant would that be? Because Dawkins could have all of that elegant evolutionary creaturely development, you know, climbing Mount Improbable and the universe unfolding and all of these creatures and all of these attributes of the universe growing and coming into existence. And it could all be, you know, evolving and all of that stuff could be happening from the point of ultimate simplicity, just like Dawkins is asking for. And what could be more elegant than a divine mind at the very base of the slope of Mount Improbable? Because that is the, like Swinburne and William Lane Craig say, that is the ultimate simplicity, a pure mind who invents the material world, and then off you go, the whole thing can start. But that's the big hang-up. Dawkins is fixated on God can't be at the shallow end of Mount Improbable. He would have to be the great big complex improbable thing, you know, at the sheer cliff face, which is why, you know, two commentators that I also read and that I include in the book as well, I think they're Catholics, Scott Hahn and Benjamin Weicker. The way that they sum it up is basically that at best, Dawkins has shown that a highly magnified Richard Dawkins could not have been the cause of the universe. Of that, we are already well aware. So I just get the sense for Dawkins, the challenge is fundamentally questioning his materialist presuppositions. Now, I don't know how and when that's going to happen, but, you know, little moments like that with Francis Collins, that gives me a bit of hope. It's interesting. We're just gonna have to watch and see what happens next.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what happens next, just as we come to the end of this, Peter, do you have any idea? In some ways, we're seeing, and I think particularly, you know, through this book, Coming to Faith through Dawkins, we're seeing a kind of waning of New Atheism. But do you have any idea what the new atheism will be? What is it that's gonna, in some ways, be next? You know, where are we gonna see, not just the country but the world go in terms of these sort of religious discussions and atheistic discussions? Do you think?
God, it's such a good question, isn't it? I mean, I think as far as the new atheism of Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Dennett is concerned, I'm tempted to say, for what it's worth, that it's probably still making some ripples, but they ran out of stones. I think that's what's happened. I do think the new atheist movement has exhausted itself, and all sorts of commentators have, you know, sort of explained why better than I, and Alistair McGrath did a good job of that as well. But I think the thing that I'm a bit sad about, but again, this is only from my limited perspective in my walk of life, there might be other people for whom it's very different. I got the sense that when I was at university and all this was kicking off, it was a great time where you could dig into these issues from the top down. You could basically cut right to the chase and go for a big debate about, does God exist? Is there a purpose to the universe? Yes or no, maybe, what is it, whatever, and get people arguing. partly because of Dawkins. This is where I need to say thank you, Dawkins. You helped make that happen, and people got talking about it more. Those bus adverts contributed to it. There was a real rigor of people being able to dive straight in and have, you know, God conversations. Now, however, I don't get the sense that that's happening. I get the sense that it's not about going straight for the question of, does God exist? You know, did Jesus rise again? You know, is there a purpose? I get the sense that it's more about going from the bottom up rather than the top down. I get the sense that people at the moment are just generally overwhelmed, struggling to get through their day, and are almost looking for pragmatic approaches. Which might be why people like, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, and there are probably people hearing this going, oh, I'm sick of hearing this. But it might be why people like Jordan Peterson have taken off, because even though, yeah, he is not an outright, you know, what you would call a Christian, you know, he is definitely kind of, you know, playing around with the spiritual realm and the Bible and Christian worldview ideas, but he's going from the bottom up. He's going from, you know, stand up straight, make your bed, and trying to help people get their life back in order and more bearable. And then again, you've got all of the what people, you know, some people call, you know, the culture wars and woke and all that kind of stuff. And people are getting really worked up over identity issues and political issues. These are all things that are at a lower existential horizon than the really big questions about, does God exist? You know, does anything happen after death? We've got so wound up about what's happening in the here and now. And, you know, for big things that do affect people, these aren't trivial things. But we're so wound up about that that it's harder to have the big, direct theism-atheism questions. And on the subject of things changing, it was really interesting as well. You know, we've been speculating about, will Dawkins soften up a bit to be more open about reevaluating his arguments? But I was watching a discussion he had recently with Peter Boghossian, where he actually said there might be some circumstances where it's better for people to stay Christians than to try to persuade them into atheism, because their Christian beliefs might be safeguarding them against something worse coming in to fill the void that's left when the Christian belief goes. I would never have... I mean, could you imagine him saying that in 2006 or even 2011 or 2014? That is new, and that's interesting. So I think even Dawkins and these people are grappling with, it's not just a straight case of, you know, knock religious belief out and then you get a rational scientific utopia. We've ended up with what he might even call a sort of postmodern nightmare, given that Dawkins is a modernist, I think it's fair to call him. So in terms of what will the new atheism look like, I think the best of it is probably conversations with atheists and people of different views, which are more rigorous. You know, there was like Thomas Nagel, for example, who I quoted back then. He's got a much more rigorous idea of what God is and the arguments. I'm hoping that there will be better quality and more nuanced conversations with more respectful engagement, partly because we saw that the new atheist model, it's not a very good one. But equally, things are getting more harsh now with people arguing on social media and all that kind of stuff. So I just get the sense that... in terms of a new atheism, I think atheism seems to be assumed more than even more than argued for. So the question will be, will people start to see cracks in atheism and wonder maybe there's something else in it after all? And that's, you know, what there's speculation about some of that in the book. And then there's Justin Brierley's book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, that's looking into this stuff. And you've had a brilliant conversation with Alistair McGrath and Alex O'Connor on this as well. So in terms of where things are going, I'm not sure, but it looks like it's bottom up rather than top down. That's the best I can say.
Great. Well, Peter, I've so enjoyed our conversation, and obviously we're colleagues. You now work with Unbelievable, which is amazing. But I think that's what I love about Unbelievable is we're giving people the opportunities to have these conversations in a really civil way, in a way that we're respecting people's we're respecting people, even if we grossly, grossly differ in our beliefs. And so we really would love to know what everyone else thinks about this stuff. Please do let us know, because it's just no one, let's be honest, no one knows where this is going to go, really. And in some senses, it is a kind of question of watch this space. But Peter, I've so appreciated our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Ruth. It's been brilliant.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.